not the best fitted. The crown will suit me as it never suited Robert and would not suit Stannis.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each episode for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to George R.R. Martin, Fantasy Flight Games, Card Game DB, and you, our loyal and new listeners. Check us out at www.whitebookpodcast.com and contact us on Facebook and Twitter or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This CC licensed music is Townfish by Spinozar.
Renly just jumping right to the point. He should be king, right?
Well, spoilers, Will. Spoilers.
Too bad? You listen to this podcast, you're going to get occasional spoilers.
Yeah.
We're not spoiling book like 5 and 6 or anything.
Spoiling the books, you're spoiling your own show.
I mean, at this point, as far as the books go, I think we've passed like a 10-year moratorium pretty easily on that particular bit of knowledge. As far as the show goes, we've passed pretty soon it's going to be 4 seasons, like, since that kind of thing happened, so...
Yeah. So if you're starting the game and not actually reading it, you're going to get occasionally spoiled. Try not to pay too much attention.
Yeah, yeah. From us...
In the meantime, I do think Renly is probably, of the War of the Five Kings king, the most suited to ruling Westeros.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I strongly disagree with both of you, and I will forward you an essay that argues why Renly would be kind of crappy.
Okay, well let's do this real quick. I'm gonna go ahead and tell listeners that this is episode 222 of the podcast now known as The White Book. I wanted to kind of come up with a symbol and do the whole prince thing, but it didn't work out. So we're The White Book. I'm Will.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Roy, also known as Faux Intel on the boards.
Bam. Oh, I guess I'm also known as Canon on the boards, if you look at those, and I post.
And I'm Pulse Glazer, and I talk too much. So
Aaron
back to
has
Renly.
A lot of free time.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so
Aaron thinks fast.
I got to find out a little bit. Like, I don't want the whole essay. Roy, give me the like 3-sentence bullet point rundown of your viewpoint there.
Basically, that Renly's entire claim on the throne utterly attacks the social structure of Westeros. The fact that he's willing to skip over Stannis, who, if you throw Joffrey and all of the, you know, Robert's supposed children out the window, Stannis by right. And the same way it would work in all, you know, hacking that utterly destroys the entire social structure. Boom.
So I'm okay with destroying a social structure that is built to keep those that are powerful in power and minimize those who are not born directly into power. What's far, far more important in Renly's case is that he would be the most effective king. Rob is a teenager who listens to a bunch of jerks, including his mama. Stannis has no sense of mercy and would be a terrible king. Joffrey is a freaking sociopath. Balon is practically a freaking sociopath, culture, yep. But still. So that leaves Renly as clearly the best option.
The least of these evils. And one particular note on said social structure, that gets to be kind of a wishy-washy topic since, you know, might tends to make right in feudal societies. And Robert proved that, and the Targaryens themselves did as well when they conquered all 7 of the kingdoms and deposed the, quote, rightful, end quote, kings at the time.
Yeah, no such thing as a rightful king. Rule should go to the best ruler. And of those 5 options, Renly has my vote.
I mean, sure, rule should go to the best. But you know what didn't happen?
Well, look, if we're all talking about socialist revolution in Westeros, I'm all pro that. But
whoa.
Oh, no,
I'm not talking about that.
I think social revolution.
Aaron thinks that, like, upsetting the social structure by letting Renly become king might help the downtrodden. It will not. Renly would become king in an ideal world because of his privilege and power through, like, a massive force of arms. Like, that changes nothing.
So what it might change is that younger brothers would then forever have something to look back on and say, well, maybe I should be able to inherit my father's land. And from there, it becomes a less, like, trickle-down effect of that would eventually be like, well, maybe I'm just a significantly better ruler than this ruling house, and we actually get changed.
You know, though, what you need in order to do that.
What?
Is the support of other houses, isn't it, Will?
It is! You need allies. Roy knew exactly where I was headed. Well played.
I don't know if you need allies to just murder all of, like, and I don't mean, like...
Aaron, no! No, Aaron, stop.
No, yeah, Will and I transitioned so perfectly.
Yes, it was so perfect.
Oh.
That was the transition
totally
to the card spoiler.
I'm dumb. Count us in.
So, we're going to lay it on you, listeners. We have a preview of the first chapter pack. Actually, I'm going to tantalize you. We actually have two, but we're saving one for next week. This week, though, we have Mr. Renly Baratheon himself with a fairly Nedly ability right here. So I'm going to lay his text on. He's a unique Baratheon character. He's not loyal. He's 6 cost with all 3 icons and 4 strength. He has the Lord and Small Council traits. And the text, reduce the cost of the first non-Baratheon character you marshal each round by 1.
It's good that he's a Tricon. His strength is not ideal. He's almost the weakest of the 6 costers we have.
He's really not my favorite. I mean, what of the other 6 costers would you put below him?
Thoran Martell, who has a useless ability.
Yeah.
At least you're going to get a couple extra gold off of Renly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, is it characters or is it any non-Baratheon card?
It is non-Baratheon character only. No events or attachments or locations.
So you can't use it to reduce, like, a King's Road.
Right.
But it can reduce, say,
Thinker,
like Barriss, and so on.
Or Littlefinger.
I mean, any neutral. Yes.
Yeah. But I mean, like, is that enough? I don't know. I just look at him. He has no other text. Like, he feels like he's in this, like, cost-wise, like, he's in between a couple of the other unique characters we have that give some income. You got Tywin at 7 cost, you know, Tricon, an extra strength, a keyword, an ability, and +2 gold. Or below Renly, we've got Paxter Redone at 4. 3 strength, 2 icons, a static +1 gold, and a conditional, like, extra bonus. Like, it feels like both of those on either side of him do a lot more than Renly does at 6.
It also makes it feel like Renly is overcosted by at least 1 and maybe 2.
Yeah, that's totally what I'm thinking.
I think he's overcosted because he fills a pretty solid hole, though. He's the only Tricon in Barra right now. And he makes bannering to or from Barra, lots of there, much more desirable. I think he's not a great, you're never going to run 3 Renlys, but as a one of and maybe a two of, maybe, he's a solid card.
But if he were cheaper, he would be more than a solid card. He'd be a good card that would then be an actual incentive to run those Barra banners instead of just a card that happens to be there, if you're that anyway.
Yeah, he could be a potential linchpin for those banner decks. As is, I think he's, just like you said, he's that 1x, well, maybe I draw it, and, like, I'm okay with that card. He's not something I'm like, yes, I need this.
I mean, he kind of, in a weird way, I'm not going to make that comparison. That comparison's to 1.0 and unnecessary. Instead, let's say, I can think of one situation in the future in which he might be good. Nothing has been done with the small council trait. A small council agenda that let you play all the small council members would absolutely have him as a linchpin.
Oh, like, that would be baller. I feel like that trait has to be used somehow, right? Like, we can't just get it and forget it, I hope.
I mean, in many ways, it does seem, though, like FFG is using these traits like small council in the same way people were demanding or talking about putting titles to show differences between, you know, different versions of characters. So, like, the small council version of Ned in the core set is, you know, the version of Ned that is, serving Robert versus, say, a
sort
Ned.
Sort of has a built-in seal of the hand?
Yep. If only he could be. Yeah, he does, actually. Yeah, well, I forgot what Ned did for a second, but yeah.
Yeah.
He does kind of have Seal of the Hand, so.
Agreed. But I just think it would be cool if we could run the small council together, since they are functionally together in the first book.
That's huge flavor. Like, that would be awesome.
That
like
would be pretty bold.
Agenda is, you can run all the small council characters in this deck regardless of house affiliation, but you must have a small council character out in order to claim unopposed power.
There you go. Make it a bit like the old City of Shadows from first edition. I know, I went there with the comparison, but I feel like that was a reasonable direction to go.
Credit where it's due, that part of the idea was Tommy's. He was the one who was like, it should have the same drawback as City of Shadows. I think that's an excellent drawback for that kind of deck, because it makes your agenda matter for more than just like, ooh, I get extra guys.
Yeah, and I think it extends the flavor thing too, right? Like, without the backing of the small council, you're not earning that power.
Sorry, Roy?
Oh, I was just going to say, to go back to the card of Renly himself, I think one of the reasons, though, why he's overcosted is because of how desirable Bera is as a banner house, right? The fact that it's the Neil module, it's already desirable to ban an era. Like, Renly has a chance of being a broken card if he was cheap.
Sure, but then come up
and
with a different ability. Don't make
him at the sixth spot.
Well, yeah, don't make him next to unplayable in that case. Or don't make him, like, a one of if you kind of have to, because the card pool's small.
Yeah.
If that's the case, instead you make him a different card, or a card that does something else.
That's true. But if you pick this theme for Renly, this is, I think, where he needs to be.
I don't think I agree.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I'm not super enthused about him, but, you know, I'm not sure what more can be said about him in a vacuum before we're just going around in circles.
All right. Listeners, since we know you guys like spoilers, if you'd like another and haven't noticed it yet, right below us on the page is the Quillen Tankard Regulars. They have a spoiler for a very interesting and powerful Greyjoy card. Go give them a look.
It's pretty bonkers. So for this next bit, I've got a little bit of something we want to debut here. It's something that our co-host Aaron has kind of been spearheading and trying to craft. So we wanted to talk a bit about this initiative. So we've got a message here to the Thrones community as a whole, from ourselves and the other Thrones podcasts, and it's for all of the known public discussion boards. So, in Game of Thrones first edition, there was a lot of secrecy about the decks. This has been said to slow down the meta and to limit the community. And further, this has created much more of a scouting issue and greater disparity of information, leading to an imbalance in tournaments and possibly an untrue test of player skill. And it also makes it more difficult for some new players to find and play top decks and thus improve. Therefore, for A Game of Thrones, the card game second edition, a number of metas have come together and decided to share their second edition top four deck lists. So starting hopefully at Worlds, a Google Doc will be created for the metas to input their deck lists into for public viewing on the whitebookpodcast.com under the winning decks link. Now, this is by no means meant to force metas into sharing, and privacy will still be respected. But so far, the majority of the following metas have agreed and accepted to share their deck lists at set times of the year. They include New York, Missouri, Chicago, Southern California, Boston, Florida, Ottawa, the Canadians, the Dutch, the Swedes, both Barcelona and Madrid in Spain, both the London and Cornish metas, and now we've also added Australia. So the top four decks will be shared after individual store championships, local events, and any regional where the top four player is not wanting to play that deck again that season. After regional season and after community-run tournaments, as well as after national and world championships. So those submitted decks are going to have the full deck list, the deck pilot, and the deck creator. So if your meta is not listed above, and you would like to participate in this open sharing and community building, please go ahead and get in touch with our very own Aaron Glazer through any of the usual channels. Again, he's Pulse Glazer on those sites, or email him at glazer826@gmail.com. And I feel like I should specify Glazer is G-L-A-Z-E-R. So stay tuned to all the usual Thrones networks for more information as we proceed.
We've had a lot of requests for deck building, assumingly mostly from new players, but it never hurts to have a refresher. I, with several prominent meta members, have broken down the three main types of deck. Through much discussion, it seems a lot of what is defining decks right now is economy curve and how said decks are getting economy. So we're going to go over these three deck types, which are not really relevant to 1.0. They're strictly 2.0 deck types. But before we get to them, there's some general plots that can go in every deck. So we're going to cover those first, because we're going to cover plots specific to the decks shortly, and it makes sense to cover ones that can be anywhere in any of these decks before we get to that.
Sounds good.
Alright, the first general plot that goes everywhere, and this is in literally every single one of my decks, I believe, except maybe a Night's Watch, Confiscation.
And Confiscation is the plot that, when revealed, you can choose and discard a attachment from any character, whether you control it or your opponents. And in a meta like what we have here, where Milk of the Poppy, which can blank the text box of your most important character, is very prominent, and also impactful attachments like Lightbringer, which, you know, allows characters like Bob or Stannis to stand repeatedly, or Seal of the Hand, which lets any good character stand repeatedly. Confiscation is just a really powerful spot control for these really troublesome attachments.
Yeah, and the way attachments have been pushed into a much more playable level in second edition, means that some of the, like, defining cards in the meta right now, particularly Milk of the Poppy, are attachments. And being able to have that on-demand answer to it is key.
Okay. Just for the record, the reason you don't necessarily need Confiscation in Night's Watch is that your key characters are no attachments except weapons, so they cannot have Milk of the Poppy on them. The next plot that goes everywhere is Summons. That is the plot that allows you to search the top 10 cards of your deck for a character and add it to your hand.
And this is pretty necessary because so many decks, as we'll see later in our discussion, rely on one to three impactful characters. And if you're not seeing them by turn two, just because of variance of draw, you may want to summon for them. And this is also particularly, it's a form of draw in houses like Targ or Stark that don't have as much built-in draw like other houses like Greyjoy or Barra.
Yeah, I mean, how often do you have a situation where you don't, like, where you couldn't use an extra character of your choice? Sure, it's only out of the top 10, but the way some of these ratios in deck building have changed now for second edition, all of these decks, deck types, seem to skew above the old kind of 30 character default of first edition. So your odds of having, you know, multiple characters to choose from based on the situation, you know, to grab that heavy hitter, or to that cheap claim soak, is actually even a little higher than it would have been in the prior edition.
Specifically, let's say your deck is 60 cards, which it probably should be, even though mine are always 61. After the first turn, assume you've set up 3 to 4 cards, so let's say 3 on the conservative side. After your first turn draw, you have now seen 12 cards. So your deck is only from there on 48 cards. Searching 10 out of 48 when you're running multiples of a character gives you very, very good odds of seeing the character you need. The next plot that goes everywhere is March to the Wall. When revealed, each player chooses and discards a character they control from play.
March is a very flexible plot because it is a win more plot. If you have more characters than your opponent, you can use it to reduce their character numbers, particularly if they have a better quality of characters than you do. It combos well with other removal plots and effects like Varus or Wildfire Assault. So, and it has high gold, solid gold and high initiative. So in just, it does a lot of work in your plot deck.
Yeah, it is a hoss of utility plots, with great stats. There's not many in the game that are beating that 8 initiative, and just the follow up. And the fact that it can't be saved from, with the way that some save sources have been boosted in second edition, notably duplicates being played on setup and not able to be canceled, but even the boost to attachment-based saves like Bodyguard, that keep characters on the board a little bit longer and let you protect a key character more. Well, if you can get everything else out of the way, through one means or another, this lets you just completely knock out, you know, that Mel with a dupe and a bodyguard on it and not have to worry about that.
March does at its best, or to me at its best, after Varys has cleared the board in dominance, that one character who had all the duplicates and attachments on it can then be marched right away.
Yep.
If there were two characters with duplicates, then they have a very tough choice to make, and you are still ahead of the game. It is also a reason to generally consider that Marched could potentially be a 2x plot.
Very worthwhile at 2x.
It's just a great plot.
Yep. The next major plot is Filthy Accusations. When revealed, choose a Neela character.
In many ways, it's similar to Marched. Instead of being a form of hard control, it's soft control. And this way you get to choose it. So in many ways, it's a mix between Confiscation and March to the Wall and spot control. You are saying that your opponent's best character or most impactful character is going to sit out this round unless they have some kind of stand effect, which, while somewhat common, is very costly right now, and they have to make an effort to make sure that character is going to stand. So it's usually a very reliable plot and a form of control that can go in any house.
Yeah. In first edition, I was very much a Neil sort of player over the years. And so I see a lot of value even in it not being hard control, but just being so pinpoint. The gold is reasonable. The initiative is maybe nothing to write home about, but it's not exactly a drawback either. I feel it's just a really solid all around kind of answer to keep what your opponent's doing in check. And so it's, you know, pretty frequently on the short list of plots that I'm considering to double up on.
I think a big part of its greatest strength, especially early in the game's life, is that it creates a resource disparity. You pay 7 gold for a character, your opponent plays 7 gold for a character. For the next turn, that 7 gold is knelt and wasted while yours still gets to effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the final plot is a plot that new players tend to love, partially because it gets around naval superiority, partially because the effect seems very powerful. It is Calm Over Westeros, and when it is revealed, you can choose a challenge type for the opponent and lower that challenge type's claim by 1.
What this plot, I want to hammer home something for people who may not be familiar. What Aaron says when this plot gets around naval superiority, its traits are summer, right? So it doesn't get hit. It's not a edict or a kingdom plot, and it has solid gold. It has some of the higher gold of a non-kingdom plot. That said, I have found in playing that of all the plots that we're talking about here, this has been the least useful plot and has been making it into less and less of my plot decks because it tends to be too slow. It tends to, while its gold is solid and it could be an okay opener, I found plots like Sneak Attack, which has more sort of control over the pace of the game, to be a better opener if you're trying to avoid naval superiority. But Calm Over Westeros is a very good, if this is the first time you're playing a deck type or the first time you're building in a house, it could be a very good plot to sort of start with.
You know, I'm not so sold on it being great to start that out, unless you're in melee. I don't really feel that stopping that incoming claim on a single challenge is really that big when it's, for the most part, going to be a single challenge. Sure, maybe you're stopping their extra military Khal Drogo or what have you, but that's kind of a corner case over the course of, say, you know, a large day-long tournament or something. In melee, where each player is potentially throwing that military at you, dissuading that and encouraging them to send them elsewhere so that it's not a wash, I think is much more potent. Plus, you know, if you're just setting up or, you know, playing this one big tie win or whatever without the claim soak to back it up and hoping that Calm is going to protect you, like, you're just asking for them to follow up with march to the wall on their next turn and knock out that character anyway, right? I don't know.
Makes sense to me.
I think it is the weakest of these plots that is here. I agree with Will.
Yeah.
Okay, that will cover plots. We are ready to move on to deck types. The first deck type that is prominent is the deck type that most players are building as soon as they get their three core sets. It seems like the most obvious deck type with the tweak to the rules. They are the in-house reducer decks. These decks run a ton of limited cards. They run a ton of economy. They are generally, not always, but generally banner decks where you are running a lot of big characters at three times each. Along with those big characters and 9 to 12 reducers, you tend to not have as much room for powerful effects, but you run a couple of attachments and a lot of ways to protect those big characters. What you're really trying to do is get the most mileage possible out of your characters and the effects they can have on the board, and then dupe as many of them as possible anywhere along the gold curve in order for them to be able to be protected.
Are you done, Aaron?
Yes, for now.
I just wanted to make sure if you weren't catching your breath so I could move in with my point. I found this is sort of the first type of decks that I was building when I was making proxy decks, right after Gen Con and all the excitement or building an Octagon. And what I found in playing with them though is that their tempo is very inconsistent. Sometimes you feel like you are ahead and owning people and getting all of these great characters out and getting this great economy with its perfect curve. But other times you just never feel like you're able to draw into what you need because your deck is filled with so many of these limited cards, which are so highly situational. And the setups tend to be somewhat weaker than the other two deck types that we're going to be talking about. It's just in general a very inconsistent way of building a deck in second edition so far, in my experience. It, you know, can really win a game, or it will really lose you a game. No game that I played with these types of decks ever felt close.
Yeah, I think Roy kind of hit the nail on the head there as far as it being higher variance. Because you tend toward a lot of, say, that higher cost character, and in multiples, 3X there, you wind up with more situations where where there's a large chunk of your setup gold that's already accounted for, thus, you know, necessitating all of those reducer guys to try to compensate at the lower end. And sometimes you're going to hit those hands where you hit all the reducer guys, or you hit, you know, four of the big characters, and they don't mesh well to get the most effective use out of your setup gold. Kind of the underlying thing that leads to that use, though, I think is kind of interesting that this type of deck, I feel like each of these kind of picks something that's different, about the second edition of the game rather than the first edition, and kind of tries to mold that in a particular direction. So, this deck, I think, kind of takes advantage of some of those tweaks and upgrades that we've had to the higher end of the gold curve on characters and the boost to, the playability of duplicates, and has tried to kind of own that, in a way that it can turn into wins.
Just to add a bit to our terminology for newer players, the difference in games that you win and lose with great effect, the difference in the hands you're going to see with this deck is what we refer to, and this is fairly obvious to us as older players, but always better safe. Though these are high variance decks, and the way the economy works in these decks is very heavy on burst economy, using big bursts of economy in order to get characters into play.
Yeah, and speaking of that variance and the economy, we actually accidentally kind of skipped over, I think, the fact that a lot of these limited cards also increases that difficulty, and sometimes you're going to have those opening hands where you're sitting on four limited cards, which, you know, is going to hamper your performance.
Right, and I think one of the things that is nice about this deck, though, is that it Wildfire is a very effective reset for it, because you're generally able to have three really impactful characters, you know, Robert, Stannis, and Mel out at the same time. You're able to afford them, you're able to go one turn Robert, one turn Stannis, one turn Mel, or in some other order, and then you have a couple other chuddy characters out that, you know, you Wildfire, you know, you still have three awesome characters that you afforded, you know, and then you can play a couple of Claim-soaked characters. They Wildfire, you still have those three characters. It just, if you, when you can get that burst economy that Will was talking about and Aaron were talking about and get these characters out, you really can establish a strong board position where Wildfire Assault, which isn't as good in the other two deck types we're talking about, really shines.
Okay.
I agree.
Let's look at numbers for cards in this deck. This deck is running at the very least 9 limited cards up to the full allotment of 12. It is also running 3 gold weenies and 6 if possible. This tends to leave room for at most 3 other locations. So if you have that draw location in Barra, Greyjoy, etc., you put that in. If you have that burn location, put that in, but you're not going to have room for two good locations in this deck. Part of that is because that location base is eaten up, and part of that is because we're looking at the very least 34 characters, preferably 36 or 38, because you're running so many duplicates that your functional character count is less than your actual character count. Attachments also are a bit lower. Bodyguard or an in-house attachment, generally not both, and 2 to 3 Milk of the Poppy, because Milk of the Poppy goes in functionally every deck. That leaves room for about between 3 and 6 attachments. And the rest of the deck space is events, with 3 of an in-house, and then 3 of either Tears or Put to the Sword. This deck generally does not have space for both, given how high its location and character bases are. One card that is not a personal favorite, but has been getting really good run, and it could just not be a personal favorite because of 1.0. Hand's Judgment affects a lot of removal, and the burst economy tends to mean you have extra economy for Hand's Judgment. So Hand's Judgment helps protect your characters while you find those dupes.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of Hand's Judgment myself.
Neither am I. I think it's too much of a tempo hit, and it's too obvious of a play. It's too easy of a card for your opponent to play around. It's just not a very efficient form of cancel compared to, say, Bran or perhaps some other type of cancel we'll probably see as the card pool expands.
You're committing a lot of resources to waiting and kind of hoping to have them to cancel what your opponent wants, and I don't know. Although if that deck really gets, you know, where it wants to be, maybe you have that spare left over, but I still don't think it's very effective.
And I think, just to really hammer home a point from when Aaron's this sort of lots of 3X things that Aaron said, this shows like the strengths and weaknesses of the tweaked card pool. Right, you know, it's awesome to be able to dupe these great characters, but there's also be situations where you draw, you know, you have Stannis and Mel out, and your draw that turn with a dupe each already, and your draw that turn is Stannis and Mel. You can definitely run into these problems where when you need a new character, you need Claim Soak, or you need an impactful character, you're instead drawing redundant cards.
Mm-hmm.
Another further problem with that is, I'll just give an example. When I played a game on Octagon relatively recently, I was teaching a friend of mine how to play. And I signed on to Octagon. I was going to demo a game, explain to him moves. First turn, an opponent plays Melisandre. He's going first. He kneels one of my key characters. He's feeling very good about his position. I played a couple weenies, made sure that I had enough military dominance to win military by 5, and just saved 2 gold. I put Melisandre to the sword that first turn, and turns my friend announced I'd won the game. The opponent at that point proceeded to draw into dupes of dead Melisandre, and there's not really a good answer for that. Draw is very important. Top decking in this game will be very important as the game goes forward, because it always is, and drawing those dead dupes is painful when you just need a body.
Right. So this deck then, I would say, leans toward needing to try and compensate for these issues with a couple other plot slots then, right? Taxation to try to offset the awkwardness of a bunch of limited in hand at once, and then potentially counting coppers to get a big burst of cards to get, you know, to get past those dead dupes and such later in the game, right?
Yes. In addition to those, it likes the 2 claim plots, like Sneak Attack and Winds of Winter, because it wants to keep such heavy pressure on with those big characters that you can never possibly recover and even think of doing anything to them.
I actually think the fact that decks like this use Counting Coppers really shows just the inconsistency of it. Like, to me, at least in my play, like, I found Counting Coppers to be a very much a win more card. While, yes, it does thin your deck, but it's low gold of only 2 and just 1 claim. Really just, you know, unless you're trying to just finish the game with that last draw, it's really not a plot that's going to be able to save you if things fall really far behind in a way in which some other impactful plots will.
The idea is that burst economy and having a significant amount of it by the time you would have to play Counting Coppers, you would be able to offset that 2 gold with enough other gold resources. And first edition taught us one key thing, draw equals win. The second major type of deck is plot gold decks. This is the kind of deck that I've been pushing forward in the meta. I think it solves a lot of the problems that I have with the first deck type. However, in a match between the two, the first deck type can still absolutely beat this. It just has a different set of ways to play. This deck type tends to run a lot of high and low gold characters, and it leaves out a lot of the middle characters. It wants to use very heavy gold plots to either flood the board with those low characters, or get out those big guys and keep them protected with their dupes. This can still be either one or two factions, but if it is two factions, it's leaving some high gold characters out. So, for example, if you were running Lannister to Targaryen, Targaryen to Lannister, you might want to see if you could leave out, say, Illyrio in any kind of real quantity. Or you might run 2 Jaime instead of 3 because you want to keep a lower end at that part of the curve. The high gold in plots comes in 2 real forms. I was running a Noble Cause almost exclusively as a 2-of in this deck. Alex Hines, host of Beyond the Wall, changed that to Calling the Banners, for reasons we'll get into shortly. But ultimately what I found was that using both together, using 2 of 1 and 1 of the other, is especially important. All that extra gold gives you lots of access to very, very high impact cards. Calling the Banners versus Noble Cause, guys?
Go ahead, Roy.
Right? Oh, Roy's not here.
Okay. Well, I'll go ahead and jump in then on that. And, you know, before we started discussing this a little bit prior to recording this episode, I think I would come down really heavily on the Noble Cause side rather than Calling the Banners. I feel that the Noble Cause just leaves you in more control of that ability to get the income when you need it, and to play it when you have that card in hand, and leaves that control all on your side of the table, or at least the random chance of whether you drew the Lord or Lady on your side of the table. Calling the Banners, on the other hand, puts more of that control on how your opponent's performance is, and I'm less of a fan of giving them any control in that capability to begin with, coupled with the fact that, you know, like the plot kind of begs for me to be in a worse position to get the most use out of it. So that was my initial reaction, but I may let you retort back with a little counter.
Calling the Banners offers a few things that Noble Cause does. The first and most important of these is the meta is currently being defined by, if not the best deck necessarily, defined by Barrow Fealty. Barrow Fealty runs a lot of Neil. It runs two times the Neil plot. Therefore, Neil is something you have to be ready for. Calling the Banners has high enough initiative to be able to go straight past that Neil plot and allow you to make that player first so that you can get your cards out and actually have standing characters to the challenge. Further, it is one of the best ways to set up Varus, and these decks almost exclusively run 2 to 3 Varus. Varus, as a reset in dominance, does not want to go first so that he does not get Milk of the Poppy, so that you can, you know, your opponent doesn't know to save gold to put him to the sword, and so on. So when you're going to play Varus, you usually want to be second. Noble Cause makes that more difficult, and Calling the Banners makes that significantly easier.
So what makes this deck type really strong, particularly in comparison to the previous deck that we talked about, is that it has very good tempo. And tempo as a term, you know, it's different in every different type of card game, but generally it means that you're going to be able to play impactful things every single turn. And what guarantees that in the gold deck type that Aaron's been pioneering is the plots. The plots allow you to consistently play good cards, impactful cards every single turn. And it also lets you cut down on variance, which is that you will consistently see these cards and consistently be able to play these cards and draw into impactful cards. As we said in the first deck type, this reducer deck type, things like having a lot of limited cards or a lot of dupes lower, you know, makes the variance of your deck worse. It makes it so you're not always going to be able to draw into useful cards. That is not really the case in this second type. Its draws are much more consistent. You're generally going to see the cards that you want to see or need to see than you would in the previous deck type. But the weakness here is, of course, your characters are a lot less safe. The great strength of the reducer deck is that, you know, you can have three copies of Robert and feel secure that unless things go truly terribly wrong, your Robert's going to be staying alive for the rest of the game. Your big splashy characters, your big splashy effects are less safe. And the other big drawback is 4 to 5 or 6 of your plot slots are taken up by these economy plots. And while these economy plots cut down on, bad draws, they improve your variance and they improve your tempo, they aren't always the best at giving you control over the board in and of themselves. And that's going to be really uncomfortable for first edition players. And I know is one of the hardest things for me to learn. One of the things that took me for a long time to learn in first edition is that your plot deck should be focused on having big, splashy, board impactful effects. And that is not what you're generally going to get out of about 2/3 of your plots in this type of deck.
One thing I do want to take a quick moment to jump back to slightly in that awesome kind of breakdown from Roy is just a little bit more about the term tempo. And he acknowledged that it is kind of varied a little bit from game to game that it's been applied in, though most of us that are familiar with it, I think, see it originating in this sort of realm from Magic the Gathering, though I'm aware it's been applied in a variety of others, including chess. But in this instance, in the way that I tend to think of it in Thrones, is the tempo is kind of a concept of attempting to measure a differential in efficiency of resource usage between yourself and your opponent. So, like Aaron had mentioned much earlier in the cast, about the Neil plot, wherein you are effectively spending 0 gold, though you are spending a plot slot and a reveal, which is a resource of its own, but you're spending 0 gold to negate your opponent's, say, 6 or 7 gold for a turn, thus upping that efficiency there. Or, say, I use my put to the sword at 2 gold to kill their, 6-cost Jamie or whatever it may be, tempo kind of measures how I'm able to one-up my opponent on the efficiency of my use of resources or to negate their effective use of it and try to make that differential as big as possible. So these decks then focus on getting that tempo play out of the draw deck. They sacrifice having as much capability to do it out of the plot deck by having to devote those slots to gold, like Roy said, but compensate by having a much smoother ability to gain that tempo from their draw deck by lowering that variance and having kind of a greater overall potency of their characters and other cards available to them.
Okay. That should head us over to, one more point. Will, would you like to make the John Bruno point?
The John Bruno point? Yeah, about sure.
Plots.
I would about plots. There's actually another point about these decks in general I'd like to make when we get to kind of their contents. But in particular, while we're on plots, we've had first edition 2-time champ John Bruno on the show multiple times over the years. And for folks that are or perhaps are not familiar with him, one of the really key defining factors of the game to him are the plots. And obviously most of us that have played the game at this point know that that is a unique draw to the game. But he really pushes that they're the heart of where kind of your decision-making process and your strength should be. And I think we were actually, if I remember right, in the prior episode he was on talking about claim and multiple high claim plots, which had become a big thing for a while there. And he frankly thought that, choosing plots based on stats was kind of silly, and that the effect of that plot is far more important to how that game is going to be shaped and how you should be playing to do it rather than the stat capability of those plots. So take that how you will from, again, two-time world champ, filtered through several years and a different person repeating it now. But I would hazard a guess this is not the type of deck he would show up with at Worlds.
Right. One of the big theory, open questions of theory crafting the second edition compared to the first edition is Bruno's Maxim. That really was very true when you began to play Thrones 1.0 on a highly competitive level. Is it still true for 2.0? The success so far, in our very limited experience of these kind of gold decks shows that maybe it's not the case, at least with the core set card pool. But it's definitely something newer players are going to want to keep in mind as we move into the first cycle and we move towards the first deluxe box and into the second cycle.
Also, just for new players who don't know, the plot... Do I hear crickets? That's amazing. All right. The plot First Snow of Winter is created by Mr. John Bruno, and we will be receiving it in the first cycle. Moving along to the contents of this deck. This deck, once again, is running more events and attachments and control locations than other deck types at the moment. You are almost always having Bodyguards and Milk of the Poppies, 2 and 3 of. Then you are adding almost exclusively in this deck, besides Night's Watch, 3 times Seal of the Hand. Seal of the Hand as a 3-gold unique attachment is something that 1.0 players look at and immediately recoil from. However, what matters more than having a bunch of characters very often in 2.0 is having one character that you can use multiple times, that one amazing character that's going to stay on the board and just cause nightmares. 3 times Seal the Hand means that spot removal like Confiscation can't just toss it away because it'll save just like a duplicate. Well, because it is a duplicate. And that your big characters are not only protected from Neil, but can work twice. However, Milk, Bodyguard, and Seal leave little room for most in-house attachments beyond notably Ice, Heartsbane, and Lightbringer. Even then, those tend to be 2 times rather than 3, for a total of somewhere between 9 and 11 attachments.
Yeah, one quick note, because this is the thing I wanted to jump in with here, is if I'm kind of viewing a couple of these deck types as skewing to really try to utilize something that's been tweaked about the game for second edition, I would look at this as the attachment deck. I mean, sure, that's not the whole game plan, but it notably loves attachments much more than the other two deck types that we've been looking at.
Oh, that's definitely true. And I really want to come back, particularly for newer players or 1.0 players who haven't really jumped fully into the 2.0 card pool. Seal of the Hand is a weird card. When Aaron and I were first starting to build decks together, he was pushing this card on me, and I was like, what is this? 3-cost attachment. That, to go back to Will's terminology earlier, that's a huge tempo hit for something that's not going to immediately affect the board presence. But then, as soon as you actually use the card and you see it in practice, it really pays off. It really actually is a tempo improvement. It really does improve your board state and allow you to stay ahead of your opponent. No matter if they're playing a Neil deck, or if they're playing trying to push a certain type of challenge through, putting it on a character like Tywin or Robert, can really win you the game in a way that doesn't seem obvious, and it's definitely an argument against viewing cards in a vacuum. You really should try to play with Seal of the Hand and see just how powerful it is.
I would agree. If you're looking at that tempo thing, I mean, what you're effectively doing, as long as, of course, you can keep that character on the board and all, if you're dropping that, say, on your 7-cost character, let's say it's Daenerys or whoever, yeah, and you're getting 2 uses out of her, that's essentially 14 gold worth of use, right? And you've only invested 10 gold into that versus, say, an opponent that has played out, I don't know, let's say Euron and one of the Pillage Army that I'm forgetting the name of, for that same 10 gold, though, when they use both of them in challenges, still only get 10 gold worth of effectiveness.
Thank you. You explained that much better than I was going to.
And I think it's also important that we've already said earlier in the episode that Confiscation is a plot that everyone's playing. What Seal of the Hand also does is it provides a really difficult decision point for your opponent. They have to decide, okay, am I going to confiscate away this person's Seal of the Hand on their Tywin, but leave the milk of the poppy on my Robert. It's really, it's sort of a devil's bargain that they have to make there. And that's exactly what you want to do in Thrones. You want to create a situation where a seemingly desirable move for your opponent, confiscating away an attachment, is actually going to be a difficult one for them.
So Thrones 1.0 was functionally a game of card advantage. Thrones 2.0 is a game of card and economy advantage. The three effects I think that most highlight that: draw always, but we've already discussed that. Stand creates, generally speaking, an economy advantage when used well, especially in 2.0, because mostly what you're standing is big characters. And lastly, removal, because removal for 2 gold that can take out 7 gold is a big resource advantage, even if it's not strictly card advantage.
Right, to go back to a maxim that was brought up earlier, draw equals win was the defining rule of 1.0. It's not 100% the same in 2.0. Draw is still great, but there are other forms of card advantage, other forms of, you know, advantage that you can gain that aren't necessarily drawing cards.
I think what I'm going to take to calling it, and I think it's a fair way to refer to it from now on, is resource disparity. You want to create a resource disparity between you and your opponent. To further that resource disparity, this deck runs the most strict removal of any deck. It will run 3 times tiers, or 3 times put to the sword, and then 2 times of the other, almost exclusively. It wants to be able to hit those big effects hard. With those, you'll generally see 1 in-house event, the best of them, at 3 of. Treachery being a good example in Lannister.
Oh, yeah.
Some houses, like Baratheon, have 2 such powerful, powerful events that you're going to run both. But generally speaking, you end up between 9 and 11 or 12 events.
And I would think from a level...
Go for it.
And I think this does hit on both one of the strengths and weaknesses of this deck type, right? Events are the only card type in 2nd edition that can't be set up. So you don't want to see them in your setup hand. But since you're running a solid number of them, there's a high chance you will. It is probably the point that in the deck that has the highest level of variance. Sometimes you often, in a game I was playing a couple nights ago, I saw all of these awesome events, but I didn't see any characters. And that's like that is the point of sort of where this deck can break down. In the same way that seeing too many limited cards or too many duplicates was the breakdown point of the first deck.
Time out. Well, Roy believes that's why he lost. Roy lost because of karma. Roy decided to play a Baratheon Martell Neil icon removal deck against a new player, and so karma came back and bit him in the ass.
Who That's told me to play my competitive game. Level deck against him? I had the hyenas starter decks all built to go through and talk about the game, but he came with his own net deck that he wanted to play against the best deck that I had with me, and that was the best deck I had with me that time. So I refuse to admit that my karma was damaged.
Karma, wait, what? All right. Let's move on a little bit.
I don't know. I think we should stay on 80s songs. I'm a big fan.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, I agree.
So this extra space is made up in locations. Where the other deck is running even like 12 limited locations, this deck is much more likely to run 6. Occasionally for a single house version, it'll run 8. But it's very often only running 6. The neutral ones almost exclusively, and unless you're going fealty, in which case you do the in-house and then the King's Road. That tends to cover it with the high gold. You can lower events or attachments as needed to get more control in plots, whether it be Sunspear in Martell or Highgarden in Tyrell. You are in any case running 3 times of your main house's plot. And I believe every house but Stark, right?
Yeah, every house but Stark has a good, impactful location, and Stark has Gates of Winterfell.
Yeah.
Night's Watch has the Wall, which is the biggest trap card in the game, but let's address that at a later date.
Potentially impactful.
Yeah.
One day, when the Night's Watch box comes out.
Yeah, there we go.
So, once the first set cycles out, got it. Okay. So lower locations, also slightly lower characters. I've gone as low as 30, 32 characters. I think 34 is a nice safe number for people who are trying to start this deck type. Ready for key plots?
Sure.
We discussed Noble Cause and Calling the Banners. The third key plot, I think, for this deck that a lot of people overlook is Building Orders.
And Aaron, why would they overlook it? What do people forget when they don't read the card?
The same thing you forget every time we build a deck, Roy. That Building Orders, despite the name Building Orders, does not just get you locations.
What?
relations or attachments. So it is a spot grab of Milk of the Poppy, a spot grab of Seal of the Hand, a spot grab of whatever you need at that time. Like very often you're just using it to get your draw location or a King's Road. But even that can turn the course of a game. When you're running that many attachments and impactful locations, it's an excellent card.
And it's really important for 1.0 players who just remember building orders as the melee plot that only lets you trade locations with an opponent. It has that extra usage that really makes it a very excellent spot source of resource advantage.
Before we go on, we are going to be posting decks or deck lists with all of these. Our example for this deck type is Lannister No Agenda. I've popularized this deck type. It's awesomely been recognized as the second very, like, indisputably tier 1 deck with the Barra Fealty deck, so huzzah. I feel like that's a good enough reason to post it, and it is absolutely a deck of this style. The deck reducer style is covered by either Greyjoy to Baratheon or Targ to Lannister. I have no real problem posting both, but if you'd like to see either sooner, because I'll be posting these throughout the weekend and into Monday, please do let us know. Since we've just mentioned Barra Fealty, and it is such a hot-button topic, it's something we should take a moment to delve into, if only a moment. I believe that Barra Fealty mixes the first two deck types. I think it's almost the perfect combo between the two, where it's not necessarily running the burst in-deck economy, but it is running the kind of character base that you would expect to find with all of the high cost characters in many multiples. It's running a good mix of plots between both styles. It does tend to run a higher curve and use Fealty to help smooth that out a bit.
Right. It very much highlights the ability of Fealty to act as a linchpin between the two types to sort of add an additional level of variance reduction and resource advantage that running as No Agenda or running as a banner doesn't really let you do. It lets you spend all of your gold on Bob, but still have one gold to, say, consolidate power and get that spot and heal and get Bob's Intimidate engine going.
Will?
I think that's a solid point. And it's just interesting to see Fealty serving as that bridge because it's an income card. It lets you circumvent where those two deck types are looking for income by using the agenda slot and taking some of that pressure off of both the income location slots as well as the plot gold, there for the stats. So I think that eases up and lets you find more of a middle ground there.
And I think what makes Barra, and this is sort of the last point I want to make about Barra Fealty and Fealty in general, right now Fealty's only really good in houses with a solid event package that's in-house that doesn't rely on the outside neutral events in the way in which other houses have to. And Barra, of course, has the strongest in-house event package in the game right now, and that's why I think Barra Fealty is, quote-unquote, the best deck in the meta.
Okay. Before we move on, because this has been asked of me several times since I push No Agenda so often, the difference between No Agenda and Fealty is that Fealty limits you to 15 neutral cards. Neutral cards are currently, with the size of the card pool, some of the most powerful in the game. Fealty will just get better and better, in all likelihood, while No Agenda will probably not. But for the time being, No Agenda has the ability to run 3 Varus and then 6 kill events and then some attachment removal characters and then 6 economy cards and just not worry about it. And I feel like that makes it a stronger choice for most houses, obviously not Baratheon, for most houses in the Corsair.
I mean, as long as you're allowed to run No Agenda. I've heard rumors of people in certain metas arguing that you must run an agenda so that thus you wind up, say, Lanny Banner of the Lion.
Hi, Alex Kerr.
hey, Greyjoy Banner of the Kraken is the strongest deck in the meta. I don't want to hear what anyone says. I don't know how the playtesters let that through. It's just an incredibly broken deck.
Given the Quillen Tankard regulars card, I'm not sure I disagree.
It looks real tasty.
Okay. I can't believe that's coming out in Chapter Pack 1, even if it is coming out. Whatever.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Deck Type 3 is a deck type we are functionally inventing for this podcast. A lot of things that 1.0 players have been trying to do immediately upon seeing this card pool is building Swarm decks. Swarm decks, dear listeners, do not work. What does work is what I'm going to coin the term the Mini Curve deck. It is a deck that functionally runs a 1.0 gold curve with singletons of most of the big characters, and then the occasional three of a linchpin character, as in singular linchpin character. This deck, and a side note quickly before I explain who created this deck type, when I started 1.0 a few years back, I listened to these podcasts, and sometimes I would get annoyed not knowing who people were. But what I came to realize as I became more and more active was a lot of the people that were being mentioned were people I probably wanted to listen to when they turned up on message boards, people that whose ideas and opinions I should probably pay attention to if I wanted to actually become good. So this deck type was created by Dan Struhel of New York. He founded the New York meta and is one of the creators of the DC meta as well. Fantastic player, one of the best in the world, creative deck builder. And Greg Atkinson, our own creator of 222 Knights of the Hollow Hill, two-time world champion, erstwhile member of this podcast, and gentleman whose birthday it is today.
Indeed.
Happy birthday, Greg.
Props to you, sir.
So, they both, using different houses, Targaryen to Martell, I believe, and Night's Watch to Targaryen, which just sounds crazy to me.
Notice that common theme of Targaryen, though.
Yes, Targaryen with its control effects does help this. They, with each of those decks respectively, have piloted this deck type. This is also, based on our plot discussion, I'm almost certain the kind of deck Bruno's going to favor.
I agree.
This mini curve deck has almost all of the high-cost characters. Like, it's running, like the good ones anyway, but like the Targaryen one is running Magister Illyrio, who you might not necessarily expect. It's running functionally all of them, but it's running singletons, so that if one dies, you just kind of shrug, move on to the next one. And because it's running so many other low-cost characters, it can constantly have a stream of bodies to throw at you. It still gets the impact of the high-cost characters, but also just has more bodies to do more things with.
Right, and its way of cutting down on variance is the fact that you can often play every single card you draw. And that's particularly important in the Targaryen version, right, where the draw engine is Dany. And that's a single character, and she's probably the character you may run two or three of, but, you know, when you draw the cards in your hand, you're not going to be drawing duplicates. You're going to be drawing a card that you can play either as Claim Soak or something that you're going to be able to push a challenge through. Very much in the same way that you would in 1.0. It is the closest to the 1.0 experience.
Yeah, I think this type of deck is a good one in a lot of regards to note a different way. Like, it's interesting to see that this is kind of still playing around with something that is a little different in second edition, even though it's kind of built with a first edition mentality. And the way I see that is this feels to me like this deck is putting more of that focus, back into the challenge and the plot phases. Which I think were aspects that Nate, in his kind of designer letter to us originally when second edition was announced, mentioned as things they wanted to return more focus to. So when you've got these bodies, you're looking at keeping pressure on in challenges one way or another. You're just throwing chumps at them to make them kneel or have to eat claim. You have disposable bodies to throw in front of theirs to block unopposed, or to die for military claim, so you don't necessarily have to choose, you know, that one copy of Jon Snow or whatever it was that you drew, and things like that. So I like that it kind of plays with that in a different way. And of course the plot flexibility here, when so much more of your curve is down at this lower end, like being able to dedicate things to the effects is pretty pretty big, I think. But that's the compensation, because by and large, you know, the characters in your deck don't have that impact. So there's always a trade-off.
And to build on the concepts we were talking about earlier, the way in which this deck maintains resource advantage and tempo is by having cheap characters. It makes a plot like Counting Coppers, which gives you multiple kinds of resource advantage. It gives you three cards, and this deck can still play a character because many of its characters cost two or three gold that it's able to still play despite having only that small goal on its plot, which decks like the first two would have trouble with.
Yeah. You know, and related to that, another thing that they have to really do to leverage things is lean more into that event direction, because that's where more of the permanent removal is. And, you know, the longer they let an opponent's very efficient, beefy character that does, you know, more work sit on the board, You know, the easier it is for a pile of these weenies to potentially fall behind. So they need to lean on that event slot a little harder than some of these others.
Right, which is why we see houses like Martell and Targaryen come up as really important houses for this kind of build. I mean, Dracarys is just the ideal card for this kind of weenie build.
Oh, totally. Plus the dragons to power it are weenies. So
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. And Night's Watch with it has the strongest non-location draw in the game, you know, with the Messenger Ravens, which serve so many different purposes, and in the hands of a good player can really keep that resource advantage going.
So just a quick thought about that just came to me that I think is fairly relevant, but not specifically to this part of the discussion. We discussed summons earlier as almost a mini draw plot. If you have a character with Insight or Messenger Ravens, summons is almost a multi-draw plot at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
Yep.
Okay, sorry about that aside. So the pros to this deck type are it creates a fast board with good setups, and it can be maintained. That fast board doesn't just suddenly fall apart almost ever. It's less dependent on drawing specific cards and specific combos, and therefore less likely to draw dead cards. It is good quickly, it can just overrun an opponent before they can answer, or it can play a longer game. The cons are, if the opponent gets too many bomb characters, particularly in that burst kind of deck, out too quickly, this deck can just get run over. This deck is very good against my gold style deck, but it struggles more against that burst deck when that burst deck goes off. It needs to draw, because it's going to have to cycle through characters. And lastly, Wildfire, unless you've seen your good characters, or until you've seen your good characters, Wildfire can be a fairly big disadvantage, unless you have a fair amount of draw going, or have seen your big characters, because otherwise their duped up big characters are going to be something of a nightmare for you to deal with.
You know, it's funny, while we're on that kind of plot punishing note with Wildfire, that we all feel evidently that Bruno would be most likely to play this, but we've already seen the preview of the redone second edition version of his first Snow of Winter champ card, and this is the deck that punishes the most. So it'll be interesting to watch going forward to see how the rest of the card pool develops, because overall, I would expect as a card pool grows and we get a wider range of characters that are more efficient at those lower cost slots, that this type of mini curve deck becomes better and better, and decks in general trend in this direction. On the other hand, if the pool is managed well and effects like Wildfire and the forthcoming first Snow of Winter are leveraged well, you know, maybe it keeps this in check, or, you know, maybe there's even more of that type of punishment coming down the pipeline and it pushes this out of relevance. Who knows, but it's just interesting to see that we, you know, already know there's another big hoser for this type of thing coming down the pipe.
Well, right, coming down the... Oh, go ahead, Aaron.
While Wildfire and First Snow do punish this deck type, Valar punishes the other two deck types significantly more.
Unless they have dupes.
Yes, but if they get a big character out and don't basically immediately dupe them, you can Valar pretty early against the other deck types and guarantee them dead cards.
Right.
A couple of points. First, for new players who may not know what Valar is, or Valor, it is a plot that, of course, when revealed, kills all characters play, you know, which does punish character intensive builds because it makes them vulnerable. It clears the board. It makes them vulnerable to effects like Varus and March to the Wall and things like that.
We should also clarify real quick that the full name is Valor or Valar Morghulis.
You're right.
And, also, but the other point I want to watch, just sort of as the card pool grows, the cost slot to watch, I think, is the four costers, which, seems to be the best kind of card for this deck, because four cost characters tend to be that sweet spot between affordable, four gold is pretty affordable, and still having a somewhat impactful ability. Cards like Davos or Palace Spearman or, Ranging Party, these are all really solid, efficient, but affordable characters that, you know, you can still do several things on the turn in which you marshal them.
My favorite card that can go in any of these deck types is the Wildling Horde, which, while not a four coster, is a five. But it's a five that becomes, these don't really run fealty. These tend to run two houses in order to hit that low gold curve hard enough. So since you're not running fealty, that five for seven is very good.
Until we start seeing more kneel your house card effects.
Right. We're talking about building specifically for the corset environment.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to how to build this deck. This deck is only going to run 6 to 8 limited locations, just like the previous deck style. It is going to run a number of characters that I feel like is often heavy, but functionally what that really ends up meaning is it's dependent on where your control effects come from. Because the Targaryen one that's running the extra burn is going to run extra dudes that have power icons, extra making sure of that kind of thing. Martell, if Martell is your main house, and this is the only way to make Martell your main house as a thing that can be real, if Martell is your main house, you're going to be running enough control effects that you might, you're going to be running enough control effects in characters that your character count might be a little higher. But for every house, that's not necessarily the case. Like, for some Stark decks, your character count will be a little bit lower because you're going to be bannering into that control, and thus, you know, your control effects are going to be higher in other areas. Locations, again, are fairly low, and so are attachments in this deck. Besides attachments that offer removal or offer reuse, they're just not seen. Milk is everywhere, as earlier stated, but Seal of the Hand and bodyguards are less likely to be seen because you're running less lords and ladies. Less lords and ladies means less targets, and less gold means less ability to play those cards. Characters to just die. Good.
Although what this deck type can do, though, that the other decks definitely wouldn't, is run the icon granting attachments. Like not just Little Bird, which seems to be the most common to slap on Bob or Asha or Phelan or something, but even Sirio's Training or even the Power Icon one, because it improves their setup and
does
makes their
the power
chug
icon
more efficient. No, but I know it's a zero cost awesome card on setup. It makes their crappy characters more efficient, more of a tempo gain when you play them. And since attachments bounce the hand, and your characters aren't necessarily staying in play, it's a very efficient way to cycle abilities and maintain that resource advantage that we've noted is so clear, in second edition.
Okay. That was going to be my next point, so there goes that. Events are good, but be careful with your events. You're going to want to definitely run 3 of either Seal or Tears, and as many of both as you possibly can as a general rule. But if you're not running the Wildling Horde, it's going to be very hard to get out your Put to the Swords. Your Tears are going to need a heavy intrigue presence, meaning, like, if Tyrell is one of your two houses and they have those intrigue weenies, you're a lot more likely to get use of that than if you're doing, say, Stark to Greyjoy and you have two intrigue cards.
Yeah, you don't have the slots to devote to Little Bird.
Exactly. So in that case, you're going to be using different cards. Please be aware of that. These do run more in-house events where possible, because anything that affects the tempo in your favor, and a lot of the in-house events do, is a huge plus. Because, like, you should be able to fill out a steady stream of enough that things should be feeling fairly in control anyway.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty valid point. And when we were talking before, you did kind of bring me around on the hordes, because there's really not anything else that these type of decks really want to use their house card and kneel out for. And so, you know, why not get a little more cost efficiency in? Though, again, hearkening back to the preview card from Quill and Tankard, That may change very soon.
Okay. Let's see. I feel like this kind of deck is the kind of deck that that Quill and Tankard card wouldn't really care about.
Possibly. Absolutely. But it definitely shows that FFG is willing to drop more of the Neela House card effects on us. So I'm thinking it looks like we will probably have quite a few.
Well, although at the same time, you know, your Danny is, of all the three decks, let's just say you're playing a Targaryen version of this deck, or Targaryen variant, your Danny is probably the most vulnerable of all three of the deck types, and a card like Seastone Chair can put a lot of pressure on your one valuable character.
Seastone Chair. We keep reviewing Seastone Chair. Seastone Chair is going to be good, guys.
It keeps coming up.
Spoiler alert.
I don't know why.
All right. The potential key plots. Sorry, did we give key numbers here? So you're going to tend to run mid-30s characters. You're going to tend to run 2 to 5 events at most, 6 to 8 reducers, probably 4 other locations, and then the rest you're putting into events. Potential key plots. This deck loves to claim Winds of Winter and Naval Superiority are often in these decks, and very often one of those two is your 2x plot. Did I just say Naval Superiority was 2x?
Yeah.
Winds of Winter and take, and what's sneak it called?
Attack.
Help.
Sneak attack.
Sneak attack. I'm sitting there going, take them by surprise. Take them by surprise.
Yeah.
Because 5/11 in my brain breaks everything. First edition plots, guys. When you refer to plots as numbers and now all the numbers are something different, like, it's like learning a whole new set of phone numbers.
So I hope in second edition we start referring to plots by their names instead of numbers, as someone who has terrible head for numbers.
Yeah, I remember hotel rooms by plots very often.
Like, wow, well, they're staying in the search and detain room.
Yeah,
those
exactly.
Guys are in the, negotiations of the Great Sept.
Exactly. But it's,
wow.
That's how I remember hotel rooms, because they tend to only go up to like 3 or 4. And I mean, if you're living in a 3, unless you're living in 4-3-3, you're kind of screwed. But whatever. Let's move on, because that's such a ridiculous tangent. It's entirely true, though. All right. Other plots that are key. Let's do the two that I feel like go a little bit together. And I know both of you have something to say about them. Naval Superiority and Fortified Position. Let me say what they do, and then you guys can take it away. Naval Superiority is a 2/7/1 that blanks Kingdom and Edict plots gold, as in whatever gold that was printed there now becomes 0 if the opponent plays a Kingdom or Edict plot. Fortified Position is a, I want to say, 5/3/1. It blanks the printed text box of all characters in play, except for keywords like Lord, Lady, so on. Sorry, except for traits like Lord and Lady, so on. So your Bob is now just a big body that doesn't do anything. Your Melisandre isn't kneeling anybody. Your Red Viper, just stop playing Red Viper. So that is Naval Superiority and Fortified Position. Because these guys don't have key characters that they really need, they love those two. Take it away.
Well, Aaron, you basically spoiled the entire purpose of Fortified Position, which can just shut down a turn. Like, oh, your opponent... I mean, to bring up Dan Struhal, who's one of the innovators of this deck, he's been my mentor in Thrones, and I play a lot of games with Dan, and I had this really amazing hand. I put Bob out, I put Melisandre out, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna own him this turn, I've got a R'hllor card in my hand, and he just flips, Fortified Position, these characters, and he just has a stronger board than me, and he's able to push through challenges and really screw up my plans and just switch the entire tempo of the game back to his favor. I mean, it's just a plot that since you really don't care what 75% of your character is capable of doing on the board besides being a body. It's great. It's really great in the core environment because the other two deck types are running these high impactful characters. And the reverse is true with Naval Superiority, but I think it is in many ways a higher skill cap card, very similar to first edition players, a card like Forgotten Plans. If you can hit that kingdom or edict plot that's going to get, you know, their summons, their noble cause, you know, calling the banners it still gets you at least some gold. You can really screw up their plans. You can really, really, really set the tempo in your favor. And the fact is, two gold, you know, this deck can still afford to play at least one character with that. So it definitely is, these plots really just can just shift the tempo in a way, but they can only be played because of the way in which we've discussed this deck is built.
Well, I think you just earned the nickname Little D, but Let's leave that as...
Don't let John hear that. No, no, no.
We're just going to leave that one alone. But, I mean, speaking of leaving it alone, I think that really, like, covers the salient points on those, like, well enough. I'm not sure I have anything to add on those plots.
Okay. This deck runs Counting Coppers. Counting Coppers, we discussed earlier, is the card that draws you three cards. You want to draw cards so you can keep streaming out guys, and the low gold is less of a penalty. Anything to really add about that?
No.
It's basically no. It.
Yeah.
And lastly, a plot I actually do want to take a moment to talk about. Reinforcements is a 1-0-1, worst stats in the game. When it is played, however, you can, from hand or discard pile, choose and put a character of cost 5 or less into play. That is useful for two real reasons. First is that you're running a lot of low gold plots, so you might have a major character sitting in your hand for a while, being in danger of getting killed by intrigue. Saying that little character is Tyrion and gets discarded, your opponent's feeling pretty good about themselves, knowing that you don't have that many big characters, one reinforcements, and you're right back there. The other major use is Varys clears the board. A lot of people will tell you Varys doesn't have to go in this deck. I happen to disagree. I think Varys is pivotal for this deck. Varys clears everything. If you've managed to clear everything of your opponent, because they didn't have dupes, you've probably just won the game. But if they did have a dupe, you follow that with Marched to get rid of that last character. The turn after that, you play Reinforcements, and whatever the best thing you dumped into that discard pile, including the aforementioned Wildling Horde or a Tyrion, goes right back into play. And given how low your gold curve is, assuming you've now had at least 4 or 5 plots to accumulate reducers and gold, you should still be able to afford at least one character.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely true. And the thing is, because it's 5 cost or lower, I mean, 5 cost is generally the top of your curve. Most consistently, it's going to be the top of your curve, except for maybe something like Danny. So you're going to be able to put, you know, it also solves like awkwardness if you find in your hand. If you feel like you've been able to put your cheaper characters down, but you're sort of, I don't know, you're Grey Wind. Let's say you're running Grey Wind. You just can't seem to really afford to play him. Reinforcements just gets you that immediate tempo advantage. And it can get, of course, cards that were hit from Intrigue Claim, right, you know, you were planning to play this impactful character and you're able to slide him or her right into play. It's a card that we talked earlier about how we should, you know, one of the problems of reviewing the cards that, this podcast and all the other ones and all the card reviews is viewing them in a vacuum. Reinforcements, when I first read this plot, I thought it was really just terrible, but I've actually been able to play with it both, while teaching new players the game and in more competitive settings. And it actually really is a clutch plot. A very high skill cap plot, but a very, very clutch plot, despite its bad stat line.
Yeah, I think it has a lot of capability to be, you know, slightly better than a draw to get back something, hopefully, that your opponent's already tried to find a way to deal with, or lets you counteract your own use, or heck, even your opponent's skilled use of March to the Wall. So, I mean, any card advantage there is good. I mean, draw equals win was the old maxim. And, you know, maybe in second edition, income equals win is vying for that top spot. But it doesn't mean draw or card advantage of some kind is any slouch.
Two more potential uses. First is to get back a dupe.
Mm-hmm.
You would like a duplicate of Tyrion to keep him safe because, you know, you can't stop that military this turn.
I'm not as big a fan of that use because you're really giving up the income boost there.
So the other real use is that your Tyrion with a Milk of the Poppy on him is not a great character. And your opponent's probably playing March to the Wall. And you're probably playing March to the Wall because everyone's playing March. So one of you chooses March. March your own character. Get rid of that negative attachment. And then you can easily use reinforcements to get him, assuming the gold.
Yeah.
It's still one of those pro plays of the card, but it's definitely a card that is a flex.
Our example for this is my brand new baby, a Martell Conquest Lannister, mostly because I don't really feel comfortable hosting other people's versions of this deck. There are combos that go with this deck. This deck has a combo with deck type 2 in my Stark Conquest Martell deck, where that deck runs almost a control deck with a slightly lower curve, still has a few more of the gold plots and a few fewer of the control plots. And Magic Dave
from the Targaryen TV boards, Magic being that game we all love so much, posted his Stark tank with Greyjoy, which I expected to be a purely first-type deck, but no, the gold curve is large enough that I would actually consider it a combo between this type of deck and the first type of deck. All the duplicates just are on the lower end of the curve. Very interesting and very vulnerable. So there we have it. Those are our three deck types. The Reducer Index, the Golden Plot, and the brand new Mini Curve, along with combos for how each one can work with the other.
Props and slops. Here we are, the effing gentleman. And I'm going to go ahead and hop in with one prop, though I know Aaron's raring to go with another he's got ready. And I'm going to go ahead and prop this season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I don't think I've done that yet on the show. And this season's been really solid so far. Like, it continues to just impress me with, like, the quality of attention and effects, and, like, cinematography that it's getting on ABC, you know, as compared to, say, something like Daredevil on Netflix. I mean, there's still a noticeable difference, but I'm very pleased still with how Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has been going ever since the rough start.
I will very much like to prop the Thrones Facebook group that has just popped up. We'll be posting this podcast there, so hopefully a lot of new players that are turning up in that new Thrones Facebook group are going to listen, have some new ideas, and have some comments for us. Even if not, I think that Thrones Facebook group is an excellent idea for the community. I'm not entirely sure who launched it because it's been so public run, but hey, get in touch with us, whoever you are, because A+.
I want to prop slightly a bit selfish for Aaron and I, but if you're in the greater New York City area, we're going to be seeing a launch tournament at the Uncommons, which is a game cafe in the Village right by NYU's campus. On Halloween, October 31st, 2015, 10 a.m., play starts at 10:30. It's going to be a traditional three-course set Swiss tournament. The whole New York crew, the New York Meta will be there, and it'll be a really great time. There's going to be prize support for, you know, the winner, the top four, and a lot of other sort of random prizes for other who participate. For example, Kyle and Jane, two of Aaron and I's metamates, donated a hip flask, a Milk of the Poppy flask, to give away as one of the prizes in the tournament. So there's going to be lots of other stuff like that. And so check out either our Facebook feed, Thrones NYC, or the Card Game DB thread that I've been spamming everywhere about this. And if you're in the greater New York City area, come out and check out. We're fun people to hang out with.
I'm not.
Well, Aaron is actually very fun, particularly if you get him to go to karaoke.
No, his
wife even said that they could pay their rent with Aaron's karaoke skills. So that's how good he is. So.
Or bad. Whatever. prop to the Mets, unless they blow it in the bottom of the ninth, because that's where we are. I've got a few more. Will, you're up.
I'm up? You mean, like, I have to come up with something else to say?
I think you have a flop.
Oh, slopped. Technical difficulties. Sorry, folks. The podcast has been a bit of a nightmare this week, and an extra apology to Tommy, who actually recorded a segment with us yesterday that appeared all well and good, but turned out to be empty. And props, so to speak, to my two co-hosts tonight, who had also both recorded a segment with me last night, and then when it too turned out to not work, joined me again today, and now have stuck with it through a number of connection issues tonight. So, yeah, technology sucks, folks.
And well, prop to Will, like, every listener should really appreciate Will. Like, there's been, like, he's underselling just how much of a shit show recording this episode today has been. And, you know, they've been at the mercy of my terrible, I'm staying with my parents right now because I'm going to Stephen's wedding.
How normal this is.
Yeah. It's just a shit show of a recording this time. And so Will should get extra credit, you know, stitching this together.
While we're here, I have a quick message from our co-host who was on the cast and then was cut. Tommy would like to say that when he sits down against what he considers good players in 2.0, he feels like he knows about 2/3 of the deck, that he feels that deck building is largely solved, and that it is functionally the golden deck style. Hopefully we're in the process of breaking that with the mini curve deck, so let's get to it, community. I want to prop all the co-hosts here except Roy, who refuses to play things that are fun. I want to pop this the multiverse. It is a phenomenal game, and Will likes it a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on iOS, it's on Android, it's obviously just a card game itself.
On Steam.
On Steam. But the iOS, Android, and Steam versions are about to get full multiplayer integrated. So if you've been waiting to check it out, that it literally comes out the same day as this podcast, so it is a great time to check it out.
Right, when I get back, I'll play Sentinels multiplayer with you. It'll probably be more fun than just sort of playing it by myself. Can I prop Jessica Jones? Which is what I had done last time we recorded this. The trailers for it have been dropping left, right, and center, and it just looks like it's going to be a fantastic adaptation in addition to sort of Marvel's lineup, and just makes me really excited for Luke Cage 2, which is sort of the first details of that are starting to trickle out. So it's a good time to be a comic book fan, particularly a comic book fan of really well-executed non-traditional superhero stories.
Yeah, I'm pumped to check it out as well.
November 20th.
Damn it. I want it now.
It's a month. All right, our final prop for the day is a prop to all the different metas who have agreed to participate in deck sharing. We all put a lot of work into deck. Trust me, I'm one of the most more prolific deck builders out there. It's a lot of time to really craft a good deck that everyone is so willing to open up and share their best deck, share deck, winning deck list is really wonderful, and it's great to see the community grow and grow together in that way. Will?
That closes another chapter of the White Book.
The Danger Zone lived!